Well, recently I was hanging out with a little group of colleagues at the start of the school year, people who all had graduate interns, and one of them, who was a little older than me, asked how we can help our interns be a little more resilient and a little more dependable, because he said, it seems like this generation gets overwhelmed in ways that his didn't. And perhaps you can kind of hear it already, but it just felt like the words, the tone, were kind of equal parts compassion and condescension. So it was kind of an interesting discussion we had after that. But personally, I think he had about half of his question right. I do think people are more overwhelmed today than we used to be. A lot of us find life hard and exhausting a lot of the time. But I don't think it's any particular generation. I think it's a lot of us, maybe even all of us. I get overwhelmed a lot. Most people I know of lots of ages get overwhelmed a lot. I think we live in overwhelming times. And there might be a lot of reasons for that. We won't splice that all today. But I think one of them has to be the pace of change and the intensity of change that we're all experiencing. I used to be a high school principal, and I used to go every other month to a gathering of other high school principals. This meeting was paid for by our school districts, and I think it was supposed to be something else, but it was led by a therapist, and it was really like a kind of group therapy for high school principals. We would go to this obscure office park off of 128, like one of those buildings. You're like, does the government own that? What is that? And we would sort of drive up there. We'd walk into the first floor of this nondescript office building. We would kind of metaphorically take our armor off for an hour or two, and we would talk with one another about how desperately hard the work had been lately. The therapist who had hosted these gatherings would look us in the eye and say, damn straight, it's hard. And kind of stop. Wow, thank you for that recognition. This guy, a therapist, was an expert in change, and in particular, he was a research expert in school change and how hard change was. He'd remind us that in schools these days, expectations were harder for us as principals than they had ever been. He said, I know people expect you to heal the sick and raise the dead, but good luck with that because people haven't given you any more tools to actually do those miracles with. And he'd remind us that schools these days, like a lot of institutions, like a lot of places in life, crave change. Schools are obsessed with continual, simultaneous, multiple improvements. Like everything needs to get better and different all at once. And yet, by nature, he'd point out, people hate change, and we're really bad at it. This is like a tough combination. We don't know what we're doing. We try to change things. We usually don't succeed in the changes we're trying to make. But even in the process of trying to change things, we always lose things that we wish we could hold on to. Like, that's a tough mix of things. This guy didn't give us a lot of advice. I think he gave us a little bit. I remember none of it. But he did affirm our sense that we had these overwhelming jobs, but that we weren't alone. We lived in especially overwhelming times. There's another educator, one who I haven't met personally, a more prominent one named Parker Palmer, who wrote a book recently that's kind of about this. It's about a lot of things. It's a book called On the Brink of Everything. And it's a little quirky collection of poems and essays. And partly it's a book about dying. So Parker Palmer is 80 years old. He's wrapping up a really long and fruitful career, and he's thinking more about the end of his life in front of him. And aging and death can certainly be overwhelming prospects. There's obviously so much change. There can be fear of what's ahead, loss of what's behind. But the book isn't just about aging. It's kind of about a lot of things. It's really about all kinds of change and about the possibilities that often hide right in the middle of that very difficult change. The title actually has a couple things going on at once. There's this phrase, on the brink, which usually indicates something really bad right about to happen, like you're on the brink of war or on the brink of disaster. And yet the title was actually drawn from a poem that a woman wrote about her toddler who seemed to be always on the brink of everything. This mom noticed there's always some new development, some new discovery ahead, like every day, like many times a day, caught up as toddlers are in this wide-eyed kaleidoscope of like ever-unfolding discovery and wonder, on the brink of everything. We felt like some of us who had read this book, it's actually recommended by someone not on our pastoral team, we felt like, oh, this is true of many of us in America in 2019. We're surrounded by infinite possibility, but all kinds of amazing things, ever-increasing wonder. And yet we're also kind of overwhelmed by all that's happening, all that's changing, all that's hard for so many of us. The next few weeks, we're going to kind of dig around in this and make this our theme. We've called this series, like the book, On the Brink of Everything. And today, I'm going to start out by trying to name some ways that I think a lot of us are overwhelmed, and maybe name some possibilities that hide in that being overwhelmed. We're going to join the first followers of Jesus on this weekend after Jesus' death, when they were quite overwhelmed themselves. And we'll take this passage a few sections and try and tease out some things we might see there. It begins like this. I'll read just the first two verses to start. It says, "On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, 'Peace be with you.' After he said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord." So here they are, their teacher, their role model, has been arrested and tortured and executed. Their apprenticeship, which had taken them out of their hometowns and away from their jobs, has suddenly ended. They have no livelihood. They're afraid for their safety, and they've lost what they just spent years investing in. They're overwhelmed. They've been through trauma. If you know a little history, you can just scratch the surface of their trauma in particular and unearth the overwhelming nature of the whole times and age they lived in. This early first century Judea, even though it was a long time ago, I think they were experiencing a time of immense, overwhelming change and public trauma, too. They'd been colonized by Rome, who'd cemented their rule through this campaign of terror, arresting, sometimes crucifying their political opponents. And the Roman era also brought changes to culture and technology, economics and politics that were overwhelming for this kind of rural agrarian society. Rural Judeans, like these disciples, they face these immense tax burdens, which had changed their ability to eke out a livelihood. There was actually all this new regulation over some of the industries they work in, like the Galilean fishing industry was like regulated in big ways and taxed in big ways for the first time probably ever in history. They had really stressful economic lives. And then for these guys in particular to have loved and served and apprenticed under a crucified teacher was to wonder if you too were doomed to a threatened life as a marginalized outsider or worse. So I think it's no surprise the disciples, we greet them here, are hiding behind locked doors. I heard this kind of bit in a podcast this summer that has really stuck in my mind and stayed with me, in which someone was commenting on the American experience in the 21st century, the immense technological and political and economic changes and stresses that we've collectively experienced. I was thinking about this a lot this summer. I think it's come up here as well. But in the past 18 years, we've had 9/11, we've had the war on terror, we've had the Great Recession, the rise of social media, which was not a thing then, the gig economy, Bush, Obama, Trump, Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, climate change, war on immigrants, Black Lives Matter, Me Too. I'm just like selectively naming like all these things of our public life in recent years. But so much change, so much reckoning too, so much exposure and surfacing of things that at least for some of us had long been hidden. So many collective stresses and pains being exposed. And so I think for each of these things, like whether or not they speak to our personal experiences in the world or not, we're all living in these rapidly unfolding change times of lots of public trauma. Sometimes our own, sometimes other people's, but public trauma nevertheless. We're on the brink of so much all the time. And then even when we personally aren't on the brink, when we're not experiencing trauma or rapid change, like people around us are, and together we just all get overwhelmed. And I think for so many of us, when we're overwhelmed, we have these default responses we're going to experience of numbness and fear and anger. And when I get overwhelmed, big ways, like a couple of years ago when I was crashing in ways I've talked about, or ordinary ways, like when just kind of life, daily life stresses pile up, I freeze. I just like paralyzed, don't know what to do. If I can notice it, I recognize I'm afraid. But it's not fun to feel or admit fear, so that fear can pretty quickly slide into anger or numbness, right? Lashing out on someone that's to blame, for my problems or the big problems, or avoiding that fear through distraction. I know this is not just me. I've noticed there are these huge economic and spiritual forces that are invested in keeping all of us angry, afraid, and numb. This summer, I heard this other little news report, and it was about global birth rates and how they're projected to decline during this century. And it seemed like, you know, according to at least this report, it wasn't like for particularly bad reasons or whatever. It's just sort of like a way of things that was happening. And I thought, that's really awesome. Because, I don't know, someone was born in the 70s, like my whole life, people have been talking about like the sort of rapidly growing population of the earth and how that will be difficult for our kind of climate and resources and economy and all kinds of other things. I thought, wow, like a rare good news, big picture report. Like they're going to celebrate this, right? But like as soon as the person had said this, like these facts about potentially, you know, declining birth rates, they were like, this is a bad, bad, bad thing because our economy will not bear the weight of all these elderly people and like youth won't be able to support, you know, having a bigger percentage of elders. Like what will happen this century? And I thought, like, hold on a second, because I was feeling stressed out. I was like, oh no, there's this other bad thing happened. And I thought, wait, really? This thing for so many people that if it was not going to happen was like doomsday, now that it is happening, like, that's doomsday too. I thought, this isn't fair. Like, how can we have it both ways? Everybody's, oh yeah, like, I should have expected this. Like, fear sells. Right? I'm no population expert. I have nothing to say about that. But I'm like, I know this fear sells. And we know from like social media and some analysis of how kind of news is going, like anger sells too. Headlines and stories that can make us afraid or angry, or ideally both, are really good at getting our attention. So there are lots of people and sophisticated groups of people spending lots of time and money and resources figuring out how to make you and me angry and afraid as often as possible. There's like big money in that. And then there are other people and companies spending lots of time and money trying to sell us products that can distract us from all our fear and anger. Like, obviously, a vicious cycle here, right? That there are advertisers keeping our attention, there are politicians and companies getting our loyalty and our money when we're very angry and very afraid, and then there are other corporations making money off of us when we buy their products or sell them our attention because we're so stressed out and we need to numb out from all that fear and anger. As if, like, I or you need any help getting more numb or more angry or more afraid than we just naturally would be. So I want to spend a few minutes today noticing, like, what can happen when we're overwhelmed and we start to feel numb or afraid or angry. And just to be clear, if you're like, ah, is he going to say this thing that I... Like, I actually think there's nothing wrong with being numb or angry or afraid in itself. These can be quite profound gifts. And so I'm not going to like slam these experiences, but I hope going to explore like how those can often be our reality, and there's kind of aspects of that reality that there's maybe something better than we sometimes tap into that God can help us with. That's my hope for what we'll find in our time. I want to go back to our numbed out disciples for a moment. We know the disciples are hiding behind closed doors. I'm going to take the liberty of like applying 21st century like, you know, sort of armchair analysis to people in the story that kind of maybe is or isn't in the text, but you can, you know, travel along with me to make up your own mind for yourself. But I think the 21st century version of this kind of post-crucifixion hangover, the disciples would be day drinking, or they would each be like separately scrolling Instagram feeds on their phones, like without, you know, making any eye contact, right? Because they're disengaged, I think. I think why wouldn't they be disengaged? Their lives are overwhelming in this particular moment. And so Jesus comes, and I think the first thing he does, he comes to engage with them. He surprises them. He's like, hey, I'm back. And I'm empathetic, like I've never had a person I thought that was dead show up at my door. But living in 2019, like anytime someone knocks at my door and I didn't know they were coming, that's like a shocking experience. That happened to me one summer. Almost never happens. Like here Jesus is, like doing that. He's engaging with them, and then he comforts them. He offers them peace. There was another passage I almost read and preached from today, but it was kind of long and complicated, and I was like, oh, the sermon would be 2 hours long, but it's really fun, and so I'm going to mention a couple things. This is a passage from the Bible's narrative of the ancient kings of Israel, and in this passage, the sort of global superpower of Assyria is about to conquer the kingdom of Judah. The army shows up outside the city walls, and the Judean emissaries sort of go out to greet them and say, negotiate with us in your language, Aramaic. Because listen to us, we speak Aramaic so well. Let's talk in your language. The real reason they're trying to do this is because all the people hiding behind the city wall can hear them, and they don't want their own people to hear these like really frightening negotiations. They're trying to conduct them in other people's language. But the Assyrian conquerors say, and the passage seems to imply they raise their voice. They're like, that's okay. We'll use your language. Listen to how well we speak Hebrew. And then they say, actual words from the text, why shouldn't we speak Hebrew? Because those people behind you we see at the city wall, they, like you, are about to eat their own excrement and drink their own piss when we besiege your city. We think they should know that too. Wow, that's a terrorizing moment. It's entertaining if you're not there. I think if you are there, absolutely frightening, right? So the people on the wall sit there, we're told, in absolute silence. That they're frozen, they're totally numb. I think, again, reading into the passage a bit, what keeps them from disengaging, what keeps them from just kind of checking out, distracting themselves, is partly lack of options. Like, I did not live 2,700 years ago, but from what I know of history, there are like far fewer distractions available at hand than we have in our day and age. So I think they didn't have that many options. I think secondly, there was urgency to the moment. So That invading army was not going away if they distracted themselves or were kind of numbed out. But I also think that they had this ritual to sort of stay in touch with what they were experiencing. They had this old ritual that when you experience profound grief or threat, you could tear your own clothes and take them off and put like sackcloth, like sort of burlap material on your body and pour ashes on your forehead. It's an ancient Near Eastern ritual, partly for grief, like if someone important had died, but also for other types of grief, like when this profoundly awful thing was happening that you had caused, or in this case, someone else has caused. And they do that. They had this physical, kind of bodily ritual to do in their grief, which I think, amongst other things, helped them stop and pay attention to what they were experiencing, like actually notice their feelings, help them physically express their underlying emotion rather than rush past it. And this ritual, this tearing of the clothes, this putting of the ashes on their heads in grief, becomes for them, as you read the story, a kind of precursor to a breakthrough. And just engaging their reality sets them up for the possibility of hope and action being birthed in them. They do start by just staying engaged, by feeling what they've got to feel. I think you all know that when we're overwhelmed, a lot of us tend not to do that. And I don't just mean the ashes, the tearing, but like we don't even tend to notice or pay attention to how we're overwhelmed. We all have our own ways of dealing with being overwhelmed. Some of us eat, some of us drink, some of us dig deep into the Netflix archives, like long into the night. Some of us watch porn. Some of us just endlessly like occupy ourselves with whatever we can find on our phones. Whatever it is, though, most of us have these different kind of coping behaviors that distract us from our experiences and from our feelings when they're challenging to us, when they threaten us. But that kind of shutting down isn't something that we can do selectively. When we avoid our hard experiences and our feelings, we kind of do that with all of them. So we become less relationally available. We become less emotionally available to everything. A lot of us, in my experience, a lot of us men in particular, spend a lot of our lives that way. Just kind of shut down, which is this big loss. A big loss to us, to our experience of being alive in the world. It's a big loss to people we know and love or know and love us. It's a big loss to like the possibilities of good in the world as fully alive people we get to engage in. I think the way out starts for us the same way it did for the ancients. And that has not changed, but human psychology. The way out is the same as it was for Jesus' students, too. It's to engage again in life, like whatever life is offering, to attend to what we're feeling and what we're experiencing. I noticed myself getting overwhelmed here and there this summer and looking for distraction, which is why I started back, re-engaged with a daily habit I had a little while ago, which is an old Jesuit prayer called the Examen. It's not the only way, but it's a really tried and true way in this faith tradition to engage with the stuff of our life and not to kind of shut down or distract ourselves. There's a lot of way to do this ancient thing called the examen, but at its core is kind of noticing the good and bad of what we're experiencing, what seems to be kind of bringing more life into us and what seems to be kind of life-sucking for us as well. And just kind of notice what you're experiencing and see what that calls to mind, how that makes you feel, if you're comfortable talking to God, to talk to God about what you notice. It's a way to stay engaged. It's a way to stay alive. And staying awake, staying alive in this way gives us a shot at good, engaged living in the world. It gives us a shot at hope. It gives us a shot at like working with the materials that we've got in our lives, asking what we think, noticing what we feel when we're overwhelmed. I think from there, and we're kind of attentive, noticing, we find Jesus gives us ways to be less afraid too. Another bit from this passage. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I'm sending you." And then he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." And skipping ahead a few lines, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. I love that when Jesus says, "Peace be with you," he continues to kind of show up for them more and more in their experience. He also gives them something to do. Like not something random, not just like ways to scurry around and being busy as another way of distracting themselves, but a purposeful way to participate in the good future that God is seen to be in. This seems to be one of the core functions of the Spirit of God in the world, as Jesus talks about the Spirit coming to us. Right, to persuade us internally that the future doesn't need to be as bleak as we think it might be. Here's Jesus telling his friends, "Don't be afraid, have peace. Trust that I am with you and up to something good so that you can have life." And then rather it's just like hoping it will be so, Jesus gives his friends a way to participate in that hopeful future. He says, "I've been sent, so I'm sending you. You're part of making that hopeful future happen. Participate in people's experience of God's goodness, God's gracious, merciful, forgiving, loving ways in the world." Our kind of theory of doing what I'm doing here at Reservoir, like me and the other pastors who speak, is that we'll kind of read these Bible passages and they'll soak into us. We'll apply them in our own experience so we can share our authentic ways of, you know, what we're learning about what God's doing here. Sometimes it kind of works in reverse, like and that was my experience today, which is why I'm saying this, that I have this passage, these things I want to say, and only like as I'm speaking it, it like finally speaks back to me. So that was my experience this morning. Like I had my cup of coffee and read a little something, kind of took my moment of quiet to sit with myself and sit with God and see if there's something I have to say or God has to say to me. And I was doing that this morning, and along the lines of these talk, it kind of hit me like really hard. In ways I hadn't recognized over the past month, there were like three things I was really afraid of. And I was like, oh, there they are. I'm not going to share those three because they're fresh and I don't want to, this is not a group therapy session for me today. So I'll kind of keep them to myself for this moment. But I know when I share them with my wife, Grace, later, she's going to be like, "That's rather obvious, Steve." She's trained in counseling. She like is a less numbed out person than me. She's more insightful. And so they'll be rather obvious to her. But to me, it felt like news, okay? That I was like, oh, I'm like, so afraid of these like three. And one was kind of an ever-present fear, I think just one of my angst in life. And the other two were like timely. And just like not being numb to that, just noticing and being attentive, like, oh, here's what I'm experiencing this past month. I right away just felt this like, I don't know, like taste of God's presence and movement. It kind of like quirky described, like on my bike ride here, I saw a sign in someone's yard that I bike past all the time. Yeah, they just put it up, I'd never notice it. And I felt like that sign spoke to one of my core fears, the like lifelong one, and gave me hope in a very particular way. I was like, oh, that's so interesting. And another one of the three, I didn't have anything I felt like I could do, but I felt this sense from God, like there was going to be this profound learning opportunity. Like there was going to be this lovely opportunity, that fear, to be out of control and have that be like a good gift to me, because the area I felt like I was pretty in control in. I felt like God's like, that's going to be good for you, Steve. And then this other one, I felt like, oh, I have this thing to do. I did feel like this particular way I could have kind of engaged with this person and this issue that caused me fear, that by itself was not like a solution. This was not going to make it better, but was going to be my part to do. And that felt like actually really comforting and motivating, that I had a hopeful way to engage here. And I was like, oh, there you have it, like pulling me out of numbness, engaging me right into hope. I was like, this is what God does. I find that in the circumstances and times when I most wonder, like what if I'm on the brink of a disaster? In those times, interestingly, God is on the brink as well. But God seems not to be on the brink of disaster, but more like that toddler. God's like, oh, like we're on the brink of something exciting here. It might be something old, might be something new, but there's always like something wonderful God has to unfold. I think Jesus can really empower us to stay engaged when it's easy to go numb, and that always goes better. I also think Jesus can empower us toward faith and toward hope-filled action, especially where we're afraid. And last thing I want to say is I think Jesus also can empower us to profound experiences of love, of welcoming love and offering love, especially in the places where we are most angry. In the context of today's passage in first century Judea, there was this growing, seething anger against Rome and against the Jewish elite that cooperated with Roman colonization. That anger would within a generation of this moment, find expression in a mass armed resistance against Rome, which is a failed revolt that produced like untold suffering for everyone in the region. And I hear this anger now in ways I never had before in Jesus's interaction with his friend Thomas. I'm going to read that last bit of the passage, talk a little bit about anger. Now, Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have also not seen, yet have believed." I hear in Thomas, again, kind of a new way I'm reading this passage, I hear in Thomas the anger of loss. The things didn't work out as they should have, and that makes me angry. I hear in Thomas the anger of being left out. Like, you may have seen Jesus, but he didn't come my way. What's wrong with Jesus? Or what's wrong? What does he think is wrong with me? I hear in Thomas the anger of having been lied to before, having heard false comfort and false promise that he's done falling for. I hear in Thomas the anger of enough disappointment and diminishment that he no longer thinks is reasonable to trust and hope. Anger can be a gift. Anger can be a profound and important awakening to what's true. In fact, again, I think all three of these places we go to when we're overwhelmed, numbness, fear, anger, they are all first gifts to us. They develop not just in humans. We see forms of these in all animal life, or animal life that's a little closer to us at least, because all these things, numbness, fear, and anger, they serve protective functions. Numbness, fear, and anger in the right doses at the right times, they help keep us alive. They protect us. They're really good, adaptive, powerful responses to danger. But they are also, numbness, fear, and anger, awful as unending, permanent states of being. Uninterrupted numbness, anger, or fear wreck our health and well-being. They keep us reactive to other people's stories instead of living out our own. As permanent states of being, they ruin our relationships. They ruin our society. I think that's non-theoretical. They shrink and they diminish everyone, including ourselves. If you haven't seen the Hannah Gadsby stand-up special that dropped on Netflix last year, I think you should. This is like a dangerous point as a pastor to recommend stand-up comedy to their congregation. Stand-up comics generally don't like speak like pastors do, at least in public, so you know, watch it if that's your thing. I guess not if it's not, but I think there are a lot of reasons you should watch it. One of them is a really powerful way of this professional comic says, comedy is no good for our times. In fact, I don't know if she's been serious or not, but she's like, I'm quitting being a stand-up, like at the peak of her career, peak of her excellence. Because she says, we need to tell whole stories in the times we're living in. So I'm tired of telling half stories. Because I tell half stories and they're really, really funny. But if I ever tell you the whole story, you will not laugh. You will only be angry. And then she kind of like does that throughout her show. And we are angry. We are not laughing. But then she says, you know, actually anger isn't good enough either, though. Because anger is a way to get somewhere, but it is not like an ending place. It's not a resting place. She says, we need more than anger, too. We also need connection. I've had a lot of in public life in recent years that has made me really angry. I know you have, too. I know our reasons for being angry are likely different in many cases. But just one experience for me, I find I've spent more time in the past 3 years at the State House, in my case at a local jail, more time connecting with my elected representatives these past 3 years than in the previous 30 combined. And partly that's been some opportunities that I've had as a pastor in particular, but partly anger has given me a call to action. But when this has gone well, and when this has felt sustainable, it's not been because I have something or someone to stand against in anger. It's been because that anger has clarified for me the answer to this question, like who or what do I love? How do I love myself or others enough to act to preserve and protect what I love? I'm working a bit as an organizer these days, as is Pastor Lydia, on a bill that would give all eligible Massachusetts residents, including undocumented immigrants, access to driver's licenses. Because in my case, I'm angry at the diminishment of scapegoating of immigrants in our times. I'm angry that people who pay taxes and contribute in 100 ways, people I know and love by name, contribute in all these ways to flourishing our communities, they have to be afraid that when they drop their kids off at school or when they go to work to pay their bills, they might end up through a stroke of bad luck getting deported. This is like non-theoretical. This makes me really angry. But the anger by itself doesn't give me like the energy for effective, sustainable action. I've seen some really angry activists say and do some profoundly self-defeating things. But when I remember who it is I love and who it is I want to protect, that love gives me so much more than the anger alone. That love gives me stamina and motivation that helps me engage like more consistently, I think more skillfully, more generously too. I am trying to notice and respect my anger in these times we live in. But I'm also trying to welcome love into me in the very places where I'm angry. And I'm trying to let that love give me power to love others in my anger too. I think we see this all over our material today. Like when the ancient Israelites stood behind their wall, being threatened by these Assyrian warriors that they'd have to eat their own excrement, they looked at one another. They realized this was not just about standing against an enemy. Because like in enemy fighting, they were going to lose, guaranteed. But they looked at one another, like in solidarity with one another. They said, oh, this is about protecting our beloved community. And that grew their faith. They turned to God in a kind of acts of desperate love. And that gave them courage to engage the situation, like rather creatively. At least as the Bible tells the story, it totally works too. In that principles group I told you about, where we face the stresses of our overwhelming jobs, for the most part, we did not have solutions to one another. Our problems were very situationally unique. But we did have a place to tell our stories unfiltered, unedited, and be heard and be understood. And that empathy and connection, which I will call love, that gave us power, helped us make moves to act out of creative love instead of like being reactive and anger all the time. When Thomas, the disciple, had had enough, I love that Jesus wasn't angry back at him. Jesus certainly doesn't shame or blame Thomas for his doubt or fear or anger. The kind of institutional church has been doing that ever since, this like doubting Thomas, like this like lame guy or something that we kind of hate on. But Jesus doesn't do that. In fact, it's kind of cool that it says Thomas called Didymus, which means twin. I like to think that like we're all the twins of Thomas. Like this is our way of being invited into the story of like, oh, we're there too. And I think Jesus gets it. It's like, oh, it makes sense, Thomas. Maybe it makes sense you or me that you would doubt. It makes sense that you'd be so afraid It makes sense, I think Jesus would say to you, that you would be angry all the time. But what Jesus does say to Thomas, I like to think to all of us as well, is he says, touch me. Like, I'm here. You are not alone. And God is with us as in this way still, as an ever-present spirit of love, near to us, especially near to us when we're overwhelmed. I think God is really eager to help you to stay engaged. I think God is really powerful and hopeful to turn us all from fear toward hope. And God is kind and good and present enough to say to us, touch me, to accompany us and to be present in our anger with love. I want to kind of sum up an invitation I'm making in this and then pray that we'll experience God that way, even today as we worship. In your program, there are a couple invitations. The first one I ended up not talking about last minute, so it is like the most interesting of points, I think, but it will not make any sense. So you can skip that first one. The second one, though, the spiritual practice of the week, is kind of at the heart of what I'm inviting us to try, what I think will be like a means of God being really good to us. It says, when numb, ask what you feel. I pitched a particular way of doing that called the examine, where you like intentionally once or twice a day ask God, like, what did I feel today? What did I experience today? Or yesterday, if you do it in the morning. You know, the good, the bad, the ugly. Just like, what just happened? How do I feel about that? There are lots of other ways you can do that, but just when numb, to just take stock. What do I feel? When you find you're afraid, which we often do when we take stock of our feelings, to ask, like, how can I trust and hope? How can I kind of lean into God being a dependable, hopeful presence with me? And when angry, just ask, like, who can I love? How can I welcome love in me, through me as well, even in that anger? Let me pray for this, that some of this would help. God, I do believe you are with us here in Cambridge, this day, this time, just as you were for Thomas, just as you were for the Assyrians on the wall. Just I felt you as that extra member in the room with my colleagues back in those days when I was so overwhelmed all the time. Just I felt you out on my porch today. God, I think you're here by your spirit of love, by the spirit of Jesus as well. I think you're here offering yourself, touch me, inviting us to stay alive, to stay engaged, beckoning us toward hope that's real, true, calling us, moving in us toward love. God, I pray, however numb or however afraid or however angry or maybe some of all three of those, many of us would know you with us, sympathetic, compassionate, kind, validating of those stories. And we would know you with us, offering us so much presence, so much hope, so much love right in the middle of that. I pray, God, even particularly as we sing and take communion, do our thing in this service, that you'd be the unseen presence in this room, being so good to us, bringing us fully to life. Amen.
We're going to move to a time of communion, so you can have a seat if you'd like. Communion.